Welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. I try each episode to post some thoughts to get a conversation going about a helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality. So I want to thank those of you who comment and question, because I often integrate those comments into upcoming episodes, but we'll definitely gather them all to help write the book at the end of the project. Now, the title of today's episode is this, The C Word, Rethinking Healthy Sexuality. This is part one. I'll do part two next time. Now, we're nearing the end of this section of the project where we've been asking the question, does religion have anything to offer sex education? Does religion have anything viable to give to our current social need for a rethought, reconsidered sex ed curriculum? Now, in the last three episodes, we saw how religion has long advocated for a pace that allows for sexual relationships to unfold with enough time and space for essential psychological, emotional, relational dynamics to take place. And we saw how that pacing helps our deepest relationships get on a solid footing, and how that pace also helps build sexual relationships that can last. But before we leave this question of religion's place at the table, I would like to look at a few very old words, religious words. Words that once helped us find our way in wisdom around human sexuality. Now, I say religious words, but they're not intrinsically religious, but religion has adopted them. Religion has integrated them in. So let's look at these words. As often happened, the words have lost their meaning through the year. One of them has actually taken on some toxic overtones, and my hope is to rehabilitate them and find the wisdom that was embedded in them, the practice and the thought processes that were embedded in those words, in the process to rediscover the gift religion has to offer this discussion. Now, I hesitate to even name the first word because I know it elicits negative responses. It's the one that picked up the most toxic meaning over time. But again, if we look beneath the overburden, I really believe it's a good word. And here it is. The word is chastity. Now, in the dictionary, there are several definitions of the word, but the first meaning is pretty straightforward. Don't have sex. Be a virgin. Practice celibacy. The problem is we stop reading there. You know how the dictionary works. There's the first definition and several more that come after it. And with this word, there are several more. If you read on, the definitions include pure intent or appropriate conduct. That's the one that I most value. Restraint or simplicity. But sex is a showstopper, so we usually stop after reading the first definition. But if you read further on, it starts to dawn on us that chastity is more helpful as a word about our hearts than it is about our genitals. When we stop reading after the no sex part, we miss something important. But that's what English speakers have done through the years. We've limited the word to what we do with our genitals. You can see how we limit it by putting the word into thesaurus.com. The synonyms for that word usually cluster around sex, but not just sex, dirty sex. So there are a group of synonyms around the word related to the word clean. Chastity's come to mean undirty or unobscene, unsullied, or uncontaminated. The unspoken implication is that sex makes us dirty. Sex sullies us. It is obscene. It contaminates us. So, of course, we've got a negative connotation around the word because we know that that's not true. We know sex is not obscene. We know it doesn't contaminate us. But again, let's see if we can rehabilitate the word and find the wisdom it offers us. Next in the thesaurus, there are a bunch of synonyms related to the word platonic. Words like unsexual or austere, prudish. Words like bare or basic or cold. Also, the word impotent shows up. The implication of this is chastity is about being sexless or cold or passionless. Chastity becomes frigidity in the English-speaking mind. It's a non-romantic kind of detached living. So again, of course, we dismiss the word and the virtue and the wisdom embedded in it because we know we are not passionless beings, and we know that sexuality is a deep and warming part of our lives. But again, let's see if we can rehabilitate the word. Finally, there's a cluster of synonyms related to property rights. We saw this in an earlier episode when we were speaking about how religion has thought and taught about virginity. The thesaurus associates the word chastity with an understanding of sex, an understanding of marriage that was hammered out when a woman's virginity was her husband's possession, like land or a livestock. But still today, we associate chastity with words like undefiled or uncontaminated or vestal. The implication being chastity is about virginity, and virginity is about bringing an untainted product to market. So yes, we dismiss the word chastity. We know that neither men nor women are property. We know that our sexual relationships are not about possessing one another or protecting property value. So, is there any wisdom at the center of this word? Is the word still relevant for us today? Well, I'd like to explore the word chastity as a word more about the heart than about the genitals. If we do that, the word becomes about propriety. It has to do with limits and the appropriateness of experience. In that context, as a word about the heart, to be chaste is to experience things, all things, respectfully, to drink them in only when we're ready to drink them in. When we think about chastity as a condition of the heart, then to be chaste is to take in life's experiences in ways that don't damage ourselves or one another. When it's a posture of the heart, it calls us to live in a way that does not harm minds or hearts, to live in a way that protects truth and beauty, that protects and does not injure, that enhances and does not ruin. That's what the word invites us to when it's a heart word. So I think chastity is more helpful as a relational word than it is as a sexual word. It speaks to how we relate to one another and how we relate to the world. We are chaste when we don't allow our more base instincts like greed or impatience, selfishness, that kind of stuff. When we don't allow these lower parts of us to chase experience at the expense of injuring our souls or our planet or those with whom we relate each day. To be unchaste is to do just that. It's to push for experience with disregard to any violation or reduction of ourselves or of others or of the earth. As a condition of the heart, chastity respects and reveres the processes of life. It exercises patience until the time is right, until the time is right to take in those experiences in a healthy and in a helpful way. It waits patiently until the time is right, the time to experience something without violation, without harm. As a condition of the heart, chastity champions wholeness and unity and fullness. To be unchaste, on the other hand, is to rush forward impatiently with headlong urgency to experience what we want to experience and when we want to experience it without regard to the bigger picture. Lacking in chastity, we'll see in a moment that we can use the word avarice for lacking in chastity, but lacking in chastity, we violate the well-being of a larger whole. We disrespect the long-term welfare of the self, the other, or the community. Lacking chastity, we perpetuate chaos and damage and hurt. Now, when a whole culture honors the virtue of chastity, when a whole culture is looking for the condition of heart that helps and doesn't harm, the culture will create general rules of thumb to help one another know how to behave. We create guidelines that we can follow that will help us work for the good of the individual and the good of the whole. Now, what we understand today as the rules of society or of social taboos, these often originated as these kinds of general rules of thumb, guidelines to help us advance the good of the whole and to do no harm. But as happens through the years, guidelines often become encrusted and brittle. They get heavy-handed, and sight gets lost of why they were put in place in the first place. And then, when they get applied without understanding, they can actually become, the guidelines, hurtful themselves. So, in knee-jerk reaction, they are often abandoned. Now, our own society is in such a reactionary, abandoning the guidelines response right now, in this time. But as a condition of the heart, to be chaste, again, is to experience things, all things, including our sexuality, respectfully and reverently and appropriately. It's to experience them when we're ready for them, not simply when we want them. Redefined this way, chastity is a helpful word, and it does have bearing on how we teach sexuality, because as we've seen, we do need some basic guidelines on the timing of sexual experience. We do need basic guidelines to help us discern how and when to experience the multiple layers of sexual life. But dismissing chastity, or at least the caricatured version of it, we also dismiss the ancient wisdom that was embedded in that word and in the virtue. Because we reject bloodless, passionless self-denial, because we reject arcane ideas about property rights or chastity belts, we can also dismiss wisdom that would guide us to health and well-being. By not honoring the virtue of chastity, we don't even try to arrange the order and the timing of our experiences to help and to not harm. So, when we think of chastity as a condition of the heart, it does apply to how we practice our sexuality, because there too, we do want to orient our experiences so they are right and good and helpful and not harmful. Chastity invites us to understand the human condition, and based on that understanding, to create basic rules of thumb that work. Chastity contends for what is good and helpful and proper, including the when and the why behind our experience. When is an action word that is appropriate and helpful. Why tells us when we should or should not do this thing. So yes, chastity can be a sexual word, but as a state of the heart, it is not limited to sexual experience. So before we think about how chastity applies in the context of our sexuality, I'd like to first think a moment about the society that we live in. Because chastity as a condition of the heart, contending for what is good and right and helpful and healthful, is not a particularly strong value in our society, in our culture. In our society, fulfilling our desires with urgency and immediacy, that is king. Waiting and discerning and patience, yeah, these are paupers. I had lunch with my daughter right after she got her first job out of college, and we were talking about the excitement of getting her first real paycheck. Now, the Hammock family has had a pretty simple pay-for-college plan. Mom and Dad worked hard to help each kid keep their total student debt under a certain threshold. And then after they graduated, they were invited to come home for a year or so and live for free and pay off their loans. Because even flipping burgers, a kid can earn $20,000, maybe $30,000 in a year. So it was a five-year college plan, 4 years of classes, 1 year to pay off the loans. But our daughter got married, and so she didn't come home after school, but she and her husband did a similar plan of their own. They lived super lean on one of their paychecks, and they used the other to pay off both of their student loans, and in that first year, sure enough, they paid off all of their debt. So at lunch, she was telling me all about it, and she remarked about how out of step she and her husband felt with their peers, because her schoolmates were getting their first jobs at about the same time. And regularly, they'd have the topic of discussion among them, what they were going to do with their first real paychecks. When they asked my daughter what she would do, she'd always say the same thing. I'm going to pay off my student loans. Well, yeah, they'd say, assuming that she meant the minimum payment on the loan. Yeah, what are you going to do with the leftover? What are you going to do with that? Nobody seemed to get the idea, she said, that 100% of what she was making was going to loans. In those discussions, she realized that she and Nick were really out of step with her cohort, because her cohort was using their first paychecks to put a down payment on a new car, or to qualify for a new mortgage, or to buy a new widget, or a trip, or to reward themselves for getting this far. Most were planning a 10-year payout for their student debt. Opting for experience now, they were ignoring the negative consequences later, which is what we do when we lack chastity. But that is how our society teaches us to live. Now, another religious word that needs some rehabilitation is the word avarice. It's best understood in opposition to the word chastity. We don't really use the word, but if we did, we would apply it to Mr. Potter in the Christmas movie It's a Wonderful Life. It would mean mean-spirited or selfish or greedy or miserly, which is part of the word, but it's not really the whole picture. Avarice, again, is the flip side of chastity. If chastity waits to experience life at a time and in a way that begets health and well-being, avarice does not. Avarice says, I want what I want, when I want it, and don't try and stop me. What is good for me over the long run, what is good for society, what is good for my sexual partner, these are factored into the equation at a much lower level. What I want defines how I focus my energies, that is avarice. But because we've caricatured the word into Mr. Potter terms, most of us don't think that avarice applies to us. But in fact, it's in the air that we Americans breathe. Our whole economy pushes us toward avarice. The advertising and marketing strategies of our economy work really hard to discourage chastity in our hearts. They encourage us not to consider the long-term implications of our purchases. Buy stuff now. Buy it now. Not when it's appropriate for the budget, not when it's right for the planet, no, now. On credit, if need be. Get what you want and get it now. Let tomorrow take care of tomorrow. And so, all the kids who were in my daughter's cohort were simply being good Americans. They were following our society's lead, avarice, not chastity. Right now is the time to experience that new car smell. Right now is the time to feel like real grown-ups with a mortgage. Right now. Take no thought for tomorrow. Take no thought for the burden of debt. Take no thought for the options you will not have in 5 years because you're still carrying student debt. Get what you want. Get it when you want it. Now. The virtue of chastity applied to our hearts has a lot to teach our society about health and well-being, not just about our sexuality, but basically how we approach life. Now, there is a movement afoot in our society to push back against the avarice in our purchases and to live more simply. It's a movement to live in smaller houses and to buy less stuff, to possess fewer things. It's a reaction to this institutional avarice in which we all live. If you Google the term voluntary simplicity, you'll learn a lot about that. And I think voluntary simplicity, that's a good synonym for chastity. Here in Raleigh, the local NPR station carries the Diane Reem Show every weekday. A few years ago, she was interviewing a panel of women who'd led the feminist movement in the 60s and the 70s. By the time of the interview, they were older and they were wiser and they were more reflective. And toward the end of the interview, Diane asked them, if you had a message for young women, what would it be? If you had a message for the young women, what would it be? So the discussion shifted and began to focus on these women's concern for younger women. Because younger women are experiencing the most rapid increase in stress-related health issues. Young women are exhausted. They're carrying more and more each passing decade. As careers have opened to women the last 50 years, their primary nurturing role in the family has not decreased to match. Now, families are better at sharing parenting and household duties than they were, but ancient gender roles are not dying or changing very quickly. Consequently, these older women were saying that women are now facing the problems of a successful feminist movement. We fought the battle for access, and we made a lot of progress, they said. The glass ceiling isn't gone, but it is breaking down. So it's possible, they said, for a woman now to have a satisfying career and a satisfying family. However, one of the guests said, if I have one message for young women today, it's this. You can have it all, but not at the same time. Don't try and have it all in the same year. It's a crushing burden, I would tell this young woman, to have your babies and to advance your career in the same year. You'll kill yourself. Now, at that point, the conversation shifted. It became less about politics and more about wise, caring older women advocating for the well-being of young women. They began to suggest how husbands and wives could share the load more equitably. They spoke of ways the workplace could build in a work-life balance. They spoke about job sharing, two people sharing one job, which would allow women to remain in their careers during the baby years so they wouldn't lose ground during their career development. These older women were advocating for health and well-being for younger women. They advocated stress reduction for younger women. They advocated for organizing our businesses and our society in ways that work for the well-being of all, the well-being of men and women and children and careers and home life. In effect, these older, wiser women were advocating chastity. They were affirming our desire to experience all good things, and especially for women to have access to those good things. They were also encouraging the young to figure out how to experience good things at the right time, in healthful and helpful ways, chastely. When chastity is about our hearts more than our genitals, it invites us to drink it all in when it's time to drink it in, to take it all in when it's time to take it all in. Chastity invites us to experience nothing at an improper time, to experience nothing prematurely or after the moment it stops being helpful. Avarice, on the other hand, drives us forward with fevered insistence to have it all, to have it now. Avarice sucks us into lives that diminish and wound us, and especially that wound our relationships. Avarice is about premature and irresponsible experience. Chastity is about mature and responsible experience. Again, avarice keeps our American economy going. Our best and our brightest go to work each day to market a mindset. It's the have it now and don't wait until it's appropriate mindset. In fact, our economy does best when we live in a perpetual state of wanting. Our economy works best when we're not content with today, when we believe that more stuff will make us content tomorrow, a new car, some new carpet, some new shoes. Our economic system works best if once we get the thing we want, it doesn't satisfy us for very long. It's better if it satisfies us enough to keep us doing it again, but only for a little while, so that pretty soon we get back to wanting another new thing. So every day, our brilliant marketers teach us to live in a constant state of wanting. So it's no wonder that chastity, the virtue of waiting to experience things until it's the right time to experience things, it's no wonder that chastity has fallen on hard times. And our marketers are really good at their jobs. Living in the American soup, drinking the American water, breathing the American air, it's hard not to find ourselves in a state of constant wanting, a constant state of desire for the next new thing. So when we look at chastity this way, as a lifestyle relational dynamic, applying its wisdom to our sexual relationships becomes a subset discussion, a subset of a much larger discussion that is needed in our society. But there is a reason that chastity is also a sexual word, because it can be especially helpful in this area of relationships. Rightness and propriety and a considered understanding of the why and the when, this is really important as we approach healthy sexual experience. Chastity gives us an informed understanding of the bigger picture. It guides us toward healthy relationships and sexual well-being. It invites us to explore our experiences, our decisions, with an eye to the well-being of everybody involved, both today and tomorrow. As we've said again and again, sexuality is a deep part of our humanity, and it touches our identities intimately. It makes us deeply vulnerable. Consequently, sexuality needs protection. It needs a set of guidelines, rules of thumbs that inform us about the when and the why and the how. So we need norms that protect us, and they protect each other at our vulnerable points. This is chastity's gift to us. This is what religion brings to the table when we're working out a viable sex ed curriculum. All right, we'll pick up here in the next episode, but I'd love to hear from you. Guidelines, what do you think? Rules of thumb, what do you think? What do you think about all that stuff? Does it sound limiting or does it sound liberating? I'd love to hear what you're thinking. Go ahead and post your comments. You can do it on both the Facebook page, the author page, and you can also do it at the website there. Thanks.